When Orpheus returned from the quest of the Golden Fleece, he was in love. He fell in love with Eurydice, which we pronounced at least six different ways last time. Eurydice, I don't know, Eurydice, that sounds too Italian to me. But at any rate, he fell in love with her, and it's not clear whether they married or didn't marry. At least on the day of the marriage, she was raped by Aristaeus, who we talked quite a bit about last time, who was a pretty unique chap in his own right. In fact, he sort of represents Orpheus all over again. But in fleeing the rapist, she was killed, she was bit in the ankle by a snake, and died. And Orpheus grieved for her so much, but didn't lose any of his pluck. And he went into the underworld and got ferried across the great marsh and past the three-headed dog and charmed Hades so much that Hades said that he could have his wife back, provided that he didn't look back until they were both in the light. And he played his lyre and kept all of the ugly spirits away and took her up to the upper world. And he was fully in the light, and he turned around just as she was taking her last step. She was part in the light and part not in the light. And he could not save her, and she drifted back down into the underworld. His whole life changed. He became an ascetic and a priest of Apollo, and did not worship Dionysus when Dionysus came through with his brutal wine-bibbing ways, converting people to the new Dionysic religion. And his modesty and his asceticism provoked the Menads, who were the drunken women, and they killed all of his followers in the temple of Apollo, and they took and they ripped Orpheus apart piece by piece. They threw his head in the river, and the head floated down to the sea, and of all places, it ended up at the Isle of Lesbos in a cave sacred to Dionysus, his adversary. And the head was saved there because it sang prophecy all the while it went down the stream, and it sang prophecy all the while it was in the cave. And it stayed that way until it was attracting everybody away from Apollo's oracles, and Apollo got jealous, and he came to the head and he told it to cease, and it ceased. There's an alternate version of his death where he gets struck by a lightning bolt from Zeus because he has revealed too many divine secrets which are not supposed to be. All right. Last week was a fiasco, for which I apologize. We missed about 40% of what we were going to say, and it was the best and the deepest 40%. And so we have to do a little summary this time. In fact, we'll do a little summary of all of the mystery myths and of what we were trying to cover last time with Orpheus. Now, there are several things that are common. We've looked at the mystery myths as written down by the mystery student Plutarch, the myth of Isis and Osiris. Then we studied the Eleusinian mysteries, both as they were celebrated historically and as they were covered spiritually by the mystery students. And then we looked at the myth of Dionysus, and we're now looking at the myth of Orpheus. And we find that there is something common in all of them. The first thing that is common to all of them is that there is a tremendous loss, and it's a loss by death, which has to do with the mystery meaning that you don't look for the inner meanings until the obvious forms are lost. And you have to have attached yourself to the obvious forms very much to understand the meaning when the forms are taken away. In the case of Isis, she lost a husband. In the case of Demeter, it was the hardest case of all. She lost a daughter. In the case of Dionysus, Zagreus, they were actually murdered in their infancy and had to be resurrected. And in the case of Orpheus, he lost his wife. In all cases, in the mystery myths, there is a resurrection after death. In the case of Isis and Osiris, Osiris is resurrected into the spiritual world and his active spirit is reborn in Horus. In the death of Persephone, she's Kaur before she becomes Persephone and she comes back from the dead, but she has to return every year. In the case of Dionysus Zagreus, he's also ripped into bits. He's ripped into bits by the elder gods. And Artemis saves his heart and puts it in a statue and brings the statue back to life again as either Zagreus or Dionysus. And in the case of Orpheus, Eurydice is almost brought back to life. Oh, no. And Orpheus, after going into the realm of the dead, comes back greatly transformed. All of these myths There's only one other. You have to take the handle with you, though. Yeah, okay. All of these myths involve violence, extreme violence, but of a similar variety. In the case of Osiris, he is murdered by his brother, Typhoon, who cuts him up into 13 or 14 pieces. In the case of Kaur, she is raped by Hades. In the case of Dionysius Zagreus, he is ripped into pieces. And in the case of Orpheus and Eurydice, she is raped and he's ripped into pieces. So there's an extreme violence. And in all cases, there's an extreme change of character. In the case of Orpheus, in the case of Osiris, he goes from being a tutelary god to a silent influence, but instead transforms Horus almost in the same manner that Hamlet was transformed. In the case of Kaur, she is greatly transformed from being an innocent maiden to being the bringer of destruction, because during the months that she becomes Persephone in the underworld, it's when everything dies and the destruction comes. In the case of Dionysus, he's a very innocent youth, and then after the death experience, he becomes very powerful and sort of a roguish chap. And in the case of Orpheus, as you remember, he gets changed from an adventurer to an ascetic. And all of them involve inversions, which we've been talking about, inversions and reflections, that they can be all be seen from two points of view. So therefore, if we put these all together, we can say that the initiatory experience is a divine, serious, decisive, empowering kind of experience whereby the candidate is cleansed and becomes virtuous and ascetic, but as a consequence of an extreme experience and as an experience of death, either directly or through someone very much loved. And there is a resurrection experience, and there is a trial of extreme suffering and service. All right. So So basically, that those are some of the components of the mystery myths, all that we've looked at all together. When we discuss Dionysus, we discuss the classical terms, classical to the Platonistic mystery schools, of distribution and collection. On one hand, distribution meant that the universal spirit was individuated into a myriad of many individual spirits, and these became the egos of the various life waves. In another sense, the distribution meant that the universal spirit, as it was plunged into phenomenal existence, became all of the characteristics, an infinite number of characteristics that the more phenomenal you become, you can only see one side of things. And that the truth, which is one universal, gets lost into what science works on, all the little petty details which seem to contradict each other. And then we talked about the phenomenon of collection, and that the phenomenon of collection is as an act of consciousness, taking all of these objective experiences of the distributed characteristics of the universal spirit and redeeming them and compounding them back into the one spirit again as an act of conscious work, conscious meditation. Now, we've been talking about this phenomenon, especially in relation to Orpheus, in what we have called the Orphic impossibility. The impossibility of bringing the dead back to life and bringing the light, the live, into the realm of the dead. To some extent, they were done in the case of Orpheus, but they weren't complete. We talked about the, we said that when Dionysus dove into the reflection in the mirror, he came out the other side. That is, the universal spirit, when looking at its reflection in the mind, actually penetrated through and came into the phenomenal realms, and an inversion took place. So that we, when we were looking at the Orphic experience, we said that from one point of view, when the spirit is projected into these realms in which we live, the self-consciousness is associated with the subjective, personal entity, and that becomes the assertive member, or Orpheus. And that the impossibility of Orpheus is trying to bring Eurydice into the light of this world, which is the impossibility of materializing spirit. You can't square the circle. You can't take spiritual consciousness and turn it into something physical. It must undergo the process of emanation and transformation, and it becomes representative in the material world, but it doesn't actually here. It isn't actually here. We also talked about the psychological problem that the analytic psychologist, most notably Jung, noticed, that it's impossible to take the unconscious, which they would call everything from the spiritual worlds, and bring it into the physical world, or at least bring it as it is, whole, into the material world. It just can't be done. It has to be transformed in some way or another. It can be brought through as intuitions, but it is partially brought through. Then we discussed the inverse of the myth, the way the Platonists would look at it, where Orpheus would represent the divine individual spirit, and Eurydice would represent the personality. And Orpheus could not bring the personality into the light of the spiritual worlds, into the light of God, so to speak. And that's an impossibility also, which means to say that our experience of the material world has to be digested. And when it is digested, it is then capable of being taken into the spiritual realm as impressions or as meanings rather than the concrete experiences themselves. In this, we call this process the spiritualization of matter. And we said that that was part of the Orphic impossibility also. And we said that this just couldn't be done. It had to be, we can't take our brain-mind consciousness and bring it into the spiritual world. We talked about the impossibility in another way. We talked about two processes. We didn't actually get this all said. This is a summary of what didn't get said last time. We talked about the impossibility of materializing spirit. We said that the forms will always be illusory or illusionary or sometimes actual illusions. But what made it real is that we projected the imaginative powers, the will of the spirit works through imaginations in producing forms. And these forms are not realities. But we project these forms and we step into them as though they were real. And when we do that with everything we have, that realizes them. Then the experiences that we have, we take and we distill them. And instead of stepping in as we did coming into the phenomenal realms, we draw them into ourselves as we ourselves are drawn back into the spiritual consciousness. And so this is basically the evolutionary process that we were talking about. The first process is sometimes called forgetting to remember, meaning to say that we forget to remember the spiritual nature when we plunge into subjectivity. The process of taking the experiences from the material world and bringing them into the spiritual is called remembering to forget. Because in the process of remembering the events, we discharge all of the energy that is bound up in them, and then we can forget them because we have the essence of them in spirit. All right, now we're all set to go. We have four little subtopics tonight, which I'll try to not get too long about. The first one is probably the most impractical of everything that we're going to do in all of these talks. The only thing about it is to know that it exists. And if you know that it exists, it can whet your appetite and it can get all of your juices flowing and it can bring you divine discontent. Or as was it the Chinese say, may your life be interesting. We're going to talk about another kind of Orphic impossibility. We have always talked in all of these mystery myths, we've talked about two meanings of the underworld. One, we meant the word under to mean within and behind the surface of the phenomenal world that we are in now. Then we have the Platonistic meaning where the underworld is this world. It's under all of the heavens, both physical and spiritual. And that when Persephone is raped and taken into the underworld, that to the Platonists is the rape of the spirit, and it is put into the sarcophagus, as the Platonists call the physical body. And we are the dead, and it is only through the mysteries that we can come to life and be resurrected in the spiritual world. This time, we're going to take both meanings and compound them. We're going to talk about the within and behind of the physical world being under all of the other worlds in the spiritual sense, even in the physical sense. And in order to do that, we have to talk about other phenomena first, because this is a very rare topic. It's hardly ever mentioned in any esoteric literature. And not being an initiate, I don't know the ins and outs of it, so I'm only going to talk about the idea of it. And from that idea, you can maybe try to get a hold of it. So we're going to talk about something else and take simple things like cells, which we can see, at least we can see eggs, or atoms, which we can't see. In any kind of individuated manifestation, there are two factors at work. First of all, there is the field or the protoplasm where most of the activity takes place. And then there is the nucleus. And in the nucleus of the egg or of the cell or of the atom, all of the controlling, the very mysterious controlling work, and especially the mysterious creative work, is done inside of the nucleus. It's the mystery of genetics in the case of the cell, and it's the mystery of nuclear physics in the case of the atom. The same is true in spirit of any individuated being, that is, any self-conscious being or collection of beings. Within humanity, there are the masses, which is just about everyone. And the masses learn all of the appropriate lessons at the appropriate times in the appropriate ways, roughly speaking. We've talked a lot about the primordial atom, which is the pattern of the whole evolution. But then there are those who, by extreme efforts of sacrifice, extreme efforts of service, but most especially extreme efforts of creativity, these become sort of the nucleus for a life wave. There is such in every life wave of individuation, the angels, the archangels, the archai. There is a central nucleus. And this is made up of initiates. Initiates, in the case of human beings, into the mysteries that we've been talking about in all of these talks. Now, the earth, I'll just mention something, but I won't carry it any further. In the same way that there is a nucleus and a field, even within the nucleus, there is yet a deeper nucleus, which is called highest initiate. And within the nucleus of the nucleus, there is a singular nucleus, which is usually called representative or personification. But we won't talk about that. I'll just mention that they exist. The idea can be removed that many times. Would you open the window back up again? Now, this underworld that we're talking about, the earth, manifests it itself is the body of a great spirit, collective and individual. And the earth itself is a peculiar manifestation of the principle of analogy. so that if this is the earth, on which we exist. This is the mineral, the geological stratum of the earth. And we know that passing through it and beyond it is an etheric realm and a desire realm and a world of thought and a life spirit, and divine spirit, and such like that. This has to do, and it has to do with the focus of each of those realms as associated with the earth, as though the earth itself were a great body, which indeed it is. But in a similar way, in mirror image, in reflection, there are layers of the earth. But they're not layers, solid layers of the earth. They are spiritual layers of the earth. And they are in inverse reflection to the spiritual worlds as they manifest out and beyond. I could give you the names of all of these, but I want to keep it short tonight. I've got them all in the notes, or you can get them from literature. But I think I want to keep it short, and I'll keep them out because they're of no matter or no concern to us, except if we were trying to use them, which we're not at this. We're talking about something very, very profound and august. Now, everybody goes through the life cycles of going into the spiritual worlds at death and then coming back to birth, and they pass from the region of ideational thought down to this physical earth. And eventually we'll all get raised up a level higher, and the earth, the physical earth, will be consumed into an etheric fire, and we'll only come as deep into matter as the etheric earth, but we'll be able to reach one level deeper into the spiritual realms, into the realm of life spirit, which is the realm of the Christ. And so that is something everyone does. Among human beings, those who are initiated into the mysteries, at the same time they gain access to the outer spiritual worlds, also gain access to each of the layers of the inner earth. Now, each of these layers in the inner earth, the first one is the reflection of the etheric realm, the next one the reflection of the desire world, the next of concrete thought, ideational thought, life spirit, divine spirit, virgin spirit, world of God, and at the very core of the earth is our connection to the absolute. Just in the same way that we have an invisible silent watcher that is the center of gravity, it's located at the root of the nose, that is a vacuous spot that no one can penetrate. Absolutely no one can penetrate the absolute. And the earth has the same thing at its core. Probably related to the center of gravity of the earth, but that's neither here nor there. The thing is that the initiate, by making extreme sacrifices and by doing extreme service such that it works ahead and it does more than is normally expected in the evolutionary course, develops the ability to access the spiritual worlds as seen in the inverted layers in the core of the earth. And each of these layers has especially to do with the creation of the creative activity that is going to be on the earth. When we're in the realm of thought between lives, our thoughts eventually change nature, usually the parts of nature that we're going to have something to do with, and that is a kind of creativity, but it is not the creativity of the potential to actually create in that manner. So what I'm talking about is something very, very profoundly creative. And so then, the descent of Orpheus into the underworld to save Eurydice and bring her back to life has another valid interpretation as a mystery myth, and that is in the process of gaining access to the creative powers in self as they are operative in the earth, which is our collective responsibility. We have developed the ability to create creative potential. All right. This probably gives an insight into why the second interpretation of the death of Orpheus, where he was struck dead by Zeus for trying to reveal too many divine secrets, because this is very, very closely kept secretive information. In most cases, it is pretty much obfuscated when it is mentioned at all. And this brings out the Orphic impossibility in another way. If, I don't know how to say it, if you've ever been around an artist, the artist can never really tell you how they came to doing the artwork that they did. You know what I'm trying to say? That there is a very great mystery about the functioning of the creative mind and of the creative faculty within a human being, and it is impossible to take the inner work of creation and make it manifest per se. All right. So that's another side of the Orphic impossibility. Hey, we're going along all right. We're not going to be too overstayed tonight. We may be a little bit, but not too bad. Okay, now we want to look at two more interpretations of the death of Orpheus to round out all of the other interpretations. It's really interesting. We've had, I haven't counted them all up, all of the spiritual interpretations we've had going all the way back to Isis and Osiris. We've looked at the dismemberment in about at least six or seven different ways. And each one is different. And then tonight we're going to look at two more dismemberment interpretations, all of which have to do with the mystery teachings. If you remember when we were talking about the Eleusinian mysteries, and even about Isis and Osiris, there was that Greek term called telete, or the lopping off of things. And in both Isis and Osiris, and carrying it a little further in the myth of Demeter and Persephone, we talked about getting rid of the unessentials. That is the indulgences that we have in our lives, the excess that we carry around, which the somebody like John Bunyan in Pilgrim's Progress would call our burden. We carry all of this psychic garbage from all of our bad impressions, and we carry all of these indulgences that we can't live without this, when we would probably live much better without it, and that the process of initiation in the early stages is a process of getting rid of those things. Now, I want to look at that in a little different way. I want to look at it in terms of redistribution, which is not a classic Platonistic term. It's a, it's a Richard Kapsel term. And I want to talk a little bit more about the remembering to forget. But in order to do that, I want to look at another myth. I want to bring in the death of Heracles, because the death of Heracles is similar in this regard. If you remember, Heracles fought with all sorts of people, but at one time he was invited to someone's wedding, and the centaurs became gate crashers. And most of the centaurs were pretty rowdy types, with the exception of Chiron, who was the great healer and the great teacher of many of the latter heroes. Most of them were vulgar beings, and they were very dissipant and dissolute and such like that. And they started not only eating all of the food and drinking all of the drink at the wedding celebration, but started to get rather randy with the proper ladies attending the wedding. Heracles showed up and he slayed almost every one of them with his bow and arrow, I believe. And the exception, one of the exceptions, was Nessus. And Nessus swore vengeance. And after this was the time that Heracles went through the celebration of the mysteries that we talked about later on when we were talking about the lesser mysteries at which were celebrated at Agra rather than at Eleusis. And we talked about them being produced especially for Heracles so that he could be cleansed or purged of his murders. Well, after he went through the mysteries, or as he was going through the mysteries, he was married. I won't go into the marriage story. It's a very interesting marriage story, though. But he was taking his bride and going on a journey, and he came to this very wide, wide river that was a half a mile across. And he had his club and his bow with him, and his wife was with him, but she didn't know how to swim. And along at this moment, Nessus happens to come ambling along and makes as though all is forgotten and we're friends. And Nessus suggests, well, why don't you take your bow and your club and throw them across the river, and you swim, and I'll take your wife and put her on my back, and I'll bring her across the river. So Heracles throws his bow and his club across the river and dives in, and he gets about halfway across, and he looks back, and Nessus is trying to rape his wife. So what he does is he goes for the far shore, and he gets his bow, and he kills Nessus with one arrow half a mile across the river. Of course, you know, everything is exaggerated about Heracles, of course. And as he's dying, Nessus tells, he was unsuccessful in the rape. Nessus tells Heracles' wife that she should take his shirt off and that she should dip it in the blood and sperm, his blood and sperm, and that she should then secretly, not tell Heracles how it came about, but she should secretly give it to him as a wedding present, and it'll make him be immortal, which wasn't a lie. But the effect was through blood and sperm, which are both very potent magically. I won't get into a lot of practical magic because it gets a little nasty, but he put a curse on his blood and sperm, and when Heracles put the shirt on, it began to burn. And it burned on his body like fire. The thing of it was that the harder he tried to pull it off, the tighter the shirt became and the more it burned. And finally, Heracles could stand it no more, and he rips the shirt off piece by piece, and with it comes his flesh, and he is his apotheosis, and being raised into the heavenly state is accompanied by his burning shirt being pulled off of him, and piece by piece he is torn apart. All right. Now that sort of gives you the... That is a self-done version of the death of Orpheus, because Orpheus is torn apart piece by piece by piece. Now, what normally happens in a human being is that from the moment some about halfway in between. There's the life cycle, I'll say it. From the moment that we just have a touch of the third heaven experience and know ourselves as God, to the moment of death, that these are two great demarcation points on the cycle of life. Because the moment we see ourselves and ourselves as God, we see the whole divine plan. And we're filled with the desire to manifest that. And that is the urge to live. And from there, everything spins forward and we pass through the different realms and we come to the physical realm and we attract all of the stuff of the world of thought, of the desire world, the etheric world, and the physical world to become human beings in this sense. And somewhere along in here, we're born. And everything it is for us, just as it is for the divine, we give it everything we've got, which is called the will to live, until we can't anymore, and then we let go. And when we let go, all of the energy that was bound up in our creative activity unwinds, and everything is a process of unwinding. And as we unwind, we redistribute ashes to ashes, dust to dust. When we let go of the physical, the atoms of the physical world are redistributed to the physical realm. When we remember everything, all of the energies that have passed through our etheric body, that also gets redistributed to the etheric realm. And especially as we go through the lower and upper desire world, which are called purgatory and first heaven, when we let go of the energies that were holding together our desire nature, we unfeel all of the emotions that we felt in the first place. And only thing is, instead of feeling them from the inside out, we feel them from the outside in. And there's a great objectivity that comes about in that, and then the forces are neutralized, and when the forces are neutralized, then we're free of them, and the materials of the desire world are redistributed to the desire world. And in this process, a funny thing happens. The physical, when the physical dies, and we remember it in the etheric, the essence of the physical, the form of the physical, is resurrected in the desire body. Such that, this has confused a lot of theologians for a long time. The desire body is normally egg-shaped and very fluent. But the objectification of desire in the physical body through actions and impacts, when remembered, gets built into the desire body, and the desire body takes the shape of the physical. But as it rots like the physical rots, and as we feel all of the pains we caused others, even though we may have been ignorant of it, then that part gets disintegrated, and gradually it goes until by the time we enter second heaven, which is the mental realm, all we are is like a head, which was pictured by Renaissance painters as a bunch of adult heads flying around with little wings. And so when we're looking at Orpheus, the death of Orpheus being ripped into pieces, we're looking at the dismemberment of the desire body. But this is, there's more to it. I'm way ahead of my notes here. I'm probably likely to get into... Oops. No, I'm not. Now, I want to go back to the Orpheus myth. If Eurydice, or Eurydice, or Eurydice, I don't know, represents the higher spiritual self that we can never bring completely into the material world. She represents the divine bride, the alchemical bride from heaven that we seek union with. And that spirit, the love of that spirit, is the unifying factor that attracts everything together that composes our whole life. When the spirit withdraws because it can't go anymore, then everything lets go. The top part is the threefold spirit as it focuses into the cycle of rebirth. It's the transcendent, the self. Self as idea, yes, the individuality. Yes, this is the cycle of coming down to birth, and this is death, and this is the unwinding. It's not a very good picture, not very representative. So then, when the one love of our life withdraws, then everything else comes apart. But that one love is manifest throughout all of the lower realms. Like in the desire realm, it's manifest as the force of attraction and repulsion, which is what holds everything together in the desire world. And if we look at it, then each of the things that we're attracted to, even if later we wish to repulse them, is sort of like an adulterous little love. Everything that we are fetched with is like a little love. And so, when we are looking at them from the objective point of view, the attraction, it is as though each of those adulterous little loves is like the menad that's pulling a piece of us off. However, in the case of Heracles, it tells us that for the initiate, the process is a voluntary pulling off. So from Orpheus, we see the menads then as objectifications of the little loves that we had of things that we were attracted to as desires. And that the process of remembering each of those desires and letting go of them is the process of the menads pulling Orpheus apart piece by piece by piece. Okay, now we have one more. I might even squeeze this into 90 minutes. This is unbelievable. We now have probably the most profound thing that we're going to talk about in terms of human experience in the entire year that we've talked about. And it's going to be a form of telete in another way. And it deals with something that, well, it's very hard to talk about, because it's there's a great danger about talking about high spiritual glories, that one can be get all egoistically caught up into the things that others have done, and that we vainly think that we can do all so easily. But sometimes it has to be done for the sake of reality and for its inspirational value. But in talking about it, it doesn't mean that I'm capable or do these kinds of things. Okay, we have to talk about what the Platonists called higher theurgy. Higher theurgy means intercourse with the gods in the highest sense possible. We're not talking about mediumship, which is what some people confuse with theurgy. We're not talking about omenology, and we're not talking about a lesser theurgy, where one understands the language of the gods. We're talking about a higher theurgy. And that is what is involved. Remember that the followers of Dionysus, both in the Dionysus myth and in the Orphic myth, the Menads were involved in orgies of sex and wine. Now we're going to look at them in the highest way possible, even higher than them being the desires, objectifications of individual attractive desires that have motivated us to do things in life that we let go of after life. We're going to talk about them in a way. All right. In the normal course of evolution, we are individuated as what are called virgin spirits. And these virgin spirits are, in some schools of thought, called monads. These monads pass cyclically, spirally, into different, deeper realms of matter, gaining experience and developing potential, and then they withdraw. And as they withdraw, they become creative beings instead of creatures, and they become less phenomenal beings, but more transcendental beings. This virgin spirit is clothed with the will to be, which is called the divine spirit, which is clothed with the light of loving imagination to manifest the power of that will to be, which is called life spirit. The union of the will and the imagination becomes a conception, an idea. And that idea is an idea of self, and an idea of self as God. And that is the threefold spirit that surrounds the tetral in the tetrahedron, virgin spirit. This gets reflectively projected through the mind into the desire body, the etheric body, and the physical body. So that a human being is a threefold spirit with a mind and three other phenomenal vehicles. But within that threefold spirit is a virgin spirit, which remains virgin all the way through. It's affected, but yet not affected. It watches everything that is done by the threefold spirit, and in watching, it becomes. So there is a much deeper meaning to the psychology of voyeurism or of spectator sports or something like that. It indicates a higher kind of learning on from the level of virgin spirit. The virgin spirit itself, which is universal, is dissolved in a realm that is called, in Western parlance, the world of God, meaning the being that creates everything in this whole creation. This being was called in the early mystery schools among the Gnostics and among the Greeks, it was called the demiurgos, or the demiurge. Now, in the course of normal spiritual evolution, one can come as far as an awakening of the virgin spirit. But beyond the demiurgos, beyond God, are six more cosmic planes. We are in the lowest or seventh cosmic plane. Now, if a human being cannot directly experience these things, how can I be saying even second or third hand that they exist? That between God and the connection with the Absolute, which is the Supreme Being, that there are six more cosmic planes. Well, there are special circumstances that are called higher theurgy. Now, I don't understand the conditions or the whys or the hows, but according to the initiates in the Orient, it's hinted at by Western initiates, but I'll use the Platonistic terms. Somehow, when as an act of grace and of contemplation, one can reach the realm of the Virgin Spirit, somehow, sometimes one is unified with God, with the Demiurgos. And then there is something like an updraft, is the only word I can use to describe the way the Platonists say it, that one has an updraft experience and is raised into the higher cosmic planes. And this experience of having this brief unification with the Demiurgos and being swept into the higher cosmic planes was called an entheastic orgy, meaning to be possessed of God in the highest sense, and this was meant to be higher theurgy. Now, how anybody ever took this experience and verbalized it is beyond me. Even just a little glimpse into the desire world is something that is almost impossible to put into words. Undaunted, being Orphic fools, the Platonists talked about everything between the Supreme Being and the Demiurgos. And they talked about it in terms of the Noetic, and Noetic, and they talked about it in terms of the Noetic. And these were interlocking triangles. I'll just string them out. That this would be the Noetic, this would be the Noetic and Noetic, and this would be the Noetic. And they talk about these in terms of very abstract qualities of divine attributes. And they talk about them experientially in symbols that when you read them, you actually even get a feel for something that is that far beyond you. Now, the Demiurgos is a reflection. This is meant to be a tetrahedron. It's not the way you normally draw a tetrahedron. But the Supreme Being, as manifest through the different faces of the tetrahedron, the Noetic, the Noetic, and Noetic, and Noetic, and then the bottom of it would be the Dema Urgos, which is a reflection of the Supreme Being through all of the higher beings, all of the higher states of being. The highest manifest, most of them are beyond even manifest, even personified characteristics, but the highest state of the Supreme Being that is speakable in terms of a name was called Phanes. Phanes. That is the name of the third member of the Supreme Being in the Noetic Triad. Now, this is practical. It has a purpose, just in the same way that we were talking about the retrospective technique, where we voluntarily, like Heracles, rip off our desires and become freed from them. This has a very practical thing in a spiritual sense. The Demiurgos, all right, the edges of triangles were in Greek times, as in our times, called legs. And Zeus, as the Demiurgos, we come all the way back now to the birth of Dionysus again, but Dionysus, the son of Zeus, like Zeus himself, was protected by two types of beings, if you remember, the Curetes, who were the bald, they had their head shaven, they were the warriors. And there were the Corybants, who were the crested dancers. And they were seen as sort of like cloud-like attributes that surrounded and protected Zeus so that no harm would come to him. All right, if we look at the things here, the legs, the Corybants, the orgies, and the menads. The menads turn out to be the same as the Corybants. Remember we said that literally Orpheus, in some of the descriptions of the death of Orpheus, he was ripped limb from limb from limb. And it was done by the Corybants, or by the Menads, who are just the other face of the Corybants. This says, in the process, I think it's valid on any other level. It seems to be, in my own experience, that even on the level of retrospection, when you see something objectively that you have done, and you face it, you let go of it. And the process of giving over your life, of surrendering it and letting go of something that you define yourself through, which is valuable to become yourself, but if you let go of the defining factor, which is the attribute, it is as though the attributive consciousness is ripped off from you. That the process of letting go is to have something ripped from you, and you can see the truth then face to face. And so then, I didn't go back and look up that fancy word that they have for ripping them apart member by member, but there is such a term. And so the process then of Orpheus dying by being ripped limb from limb from limb is a process of letting go of even the attributes of the divine. that cloud in protection or in manifestation, but cloud from seeing the spiritual truth straightforward. That when you let go, they rip themselves from you, and then you can see it straightforward. It's a very subtle process. In the process of retrospection, when you face something, it's hard coming to face it, but almost miraculously, you have let go of something and something is ripped away from you. You don't even feel the letting go. It's that you don't feel it being ripped from you, because you're startled when you say, "It's gone. I don't do that anymore," because the ripping away is so subtle. Okay, so we have now looked at probably the deepest interpretation of the process of the wedding with the divine on the highest level, and that wedding can only be truly consummated by being ripped limb from limb from limb, and that we give up all even abstract attributive definitions of our spiritual being and are. All right, we have one last little topic to look at, and that is what the board is all full of. We're going to get this in under 90 minutes. Wow. See, I slept well today. I had the day off of work to do things to get ready for tomorrow. We have one more great Orphic philosopher to look at. That is Pythagoras. We've looked at Plato and quite a few of the Platonists, including Plutarch, who wrote the myth of Isis and Osiris in the best form that it exists today. He held the chair of Plato in the Academy in Greece at about the 3rd century AD. Now we're going to turn to Pythagoras. And we're going to only take one tiny part of Pythagorean thought, one of the easier ones, and one of the more doable ones, and we're only going to look at it a tiny little bit. And we're just going to glance at it, but it's something, again, this whole class is doing things in broad strokes to give ideas for where to jump off at. We're still on the mysteries yet. And astrologically, two planets have to do with the mysteries, Neptune and Mercury. Neptune is the planet of the Freemason turned spiritual, that is, of the occultist, not the mystic, but the occultist, who becomes a magician, who becomes a healer, who becomes a creator, who is a positive, take-over type of spiritual person. Neptune is also the planet of intelligently understanding the spiritual worlds, not just accepting them and experiencing them, but intelligently understanding them. And it is the planet that has to do with strange foreign things. Mercury is the planet that has to do with mind and with the conscious focus of intelligence. It has also to do with the Mercurians, who supposedly, according to the mysteries, are human beings from the planet Mercury who helped us out as we have been far behind. In fact, they developed what are now called the Mercurial Mysteries and Hermetics and all of those sorts of things, which are names for Mercury. To this day, yet, it's called the Caduceus of Mercury. Remember when we were talking about the thyrsi that were carried at the Eleusinian Mysteries and that the Dionysians carried, the knotted ivy around the stick with the pine cones tied in it and all of those things? That is the symbol of the serpents on the path to represent the white of the egg, where most of humanity works. The rod up the center represents the straight and narrow path that is the path of initiation. And going all the way back to the way we looked at Isis and Osiris, that rod is the spine, which we've talked about in several ways relative to initiation and waking up various different types of consciousness. If we put Mercury and Neptune together in any combination astrologically, they represent tuning in. And all mystery students learn to consciously tune in. And they do it a number of ways, mathematics being among them. Tuning in self-consciously is the key to the mysteries. What we exist in is a one thing. We really, spirituality, even as dualistic as it is truly monistic. There is one thing, and that one thing takes different states according to its vibratory rate. That one thing extends on the whole pole from spirit to matter. And according to the intensity of the vibration, it is one state or another. And what we're saying is that there are, that we live within sound and light, which are two kinds of vibrations within the one thing. And there is an analogous containment of all the facets and properties of the divine at every level of manifestation of this light and sound, such that what is a color on one level, we can have a whole spectrum of colors, a whole rainbow. On another level might be a whole rainbow of pitches. So that all of the different spiritual realms have their pitches, have their colors, and have their geometric forms. Mathematics is another part of this. Within the spectrum are planetary characteristics, such that each realm and each sub-realm and each color and each sound is related to a characteristic, a quality, a living element of character that is symbolized by the nature of divinity. The process of clairvoyance, or the process of living on a given body, is a process of attuning one's consciousness to that level, which means that you live according to the characteristic, the moral characteristic, the intelligent characteristic, and you like feel the color of that. You know what I'm trying to say? That clairvoyance is not a mechanical process. It is a living process where you intentionally relive or live into what you are experiencing. This whole process of creation, or reproducing the creation in an individual through the process of initiation, is then a process of attunement. And this process of attunement can be looked at mathematically, it can be looked at astrologically, it can be looked at a number of different ways. We're going to look a little bit at one of the mathematical ways of describing the cosmos. this is going to be the arithmetic one. This is not going to be the division of the line. Pythagoras is most famous for taking a line, a string, and dividing it in different places. And by dividing it in different places, you produce a scale. And by the proportions of the parts of the string, you determine the nature of the scale. We're going to look at this arithmetically. This is from a lovely book called the Theoretic Arithmetic of the Pythagoreans. I have a copy around somewhere, but I haven't been able to find it yet. I've been looking for several days. It's by Thomas Taylor. Thomas Taylor was an 18th century British Platonist. He lived like a Platonist, and in all of his spare time, he translated Plato and the Platonists. He didn't know a lot of Greek, but he knew a lot of Plato, and he's famous for that. And this is something that he wrote on his own as a little monologue. It's not a monologue. It's pretty heavy. This is just two pages out of the book. What we have here, the Pythagoreans claimed that the lyre of Orpheus was either a tetrachord or a heptachord, meaning to say that the lyre of Orpheus had either four or seven strings. We're going to look at it both ways very, very briefly, because this is something, I'm not a musician and I don't know this, and I'm just going to talk about the ideas mathematically. The four strings on the tetrachord, according to the Platonists, related to the four elements, the four forms. And between them, there were then three intervals. And to the spiritual student, the intervals are more important than the moments. And the Platonists claimed that the spiritual relationships that were bounded by the four elements related to the triad of spiritual character. And that in that, the tetrachord and the heptachord were one and the same thing. That the heptachord was the expansion whereby the four strings and the three relations between them were expanded into being seven strings. This series of numbers here is the heptachord. And there are two lines of numbers that are each four elements. The first number that belongs to both lines of consciousness is one. So the first line is 1, 2, 4, 8. The other line is 1, 3, 9, 27. These represent powers. 1 is 1 to the 0th power, or 2 to the 0th power, or 3 to the 0th power. 1 is divisible by nothing, but yet divides everything without changing it. 1 was the very special number that was more than prime. The top of all of these is the grand triad, one, two, three, the three elements of the threefold spirit. But the threefold spirit are the three in one that are involved with creation or generation and regeneration. The line on the left here that goes 1, 2, 4, 8 is the line of generation. The line that goes 1, 3, 9, 27 is the line of regeneration or the spiritualization of matter. Now, the way this goes is that states of consciousness were geometrically defined such that the one, which is everywhere at the same time, was the universal locus. And the one was always designated eraser's wet, and I'll just make a smear if I use the eraser. The one was always designated by the point, which is the locus of being, or being in position, was the definition by the Pythagoreans. In the creative process, when the one differentiated itself into the two, that is, into male and female, into will and imagination, into heaven and earth. This is the extension of one into the line, which the Pythagoreans called the edge. So the first power of any number, that is 2 to the 1, oops, this is an error. This is not an error. I just covered it up. 2 to the 1 or 3 to the 1 represents a line of 2 or 3 units. When the point represents the mineral state, the tree-like or the stalk-like state is the line. That is something to the first power. When something becomes a discrete object, that is when it becomes a plane or a surface, is the word that the Pythagoreans used, that is 2 to the 2nd power or 3 to the 2nd power, meaning a square or a triangle. When the act of creation is carried as far as it is carried now into an external manifestation, that then became a solid. So then, the numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, 9, 27 represent, oops, I left the 8 off. 8, 9, and 27 represent the involutionary and evolutionary, the materialization or the dematerialization of the cosmos completely in the heptachord. That's the primary creation. That's the transcendental creation. What the table below it is the carrying out of the manifestation full blown, so that there are 2 columns of numbers. On the formal or material sign, they both begin with 6. But on the formal side, it is 6, 8, 9, 12, 16, 18, 24, 32, 36. on the evolutionary side or the spiritualization side or the regenerative side, it is 6, 9, 12, 18, 27, 36, 54, 81, 108, and 162. There are duplicates between the two sides. These are formulas for part of the way they are generated by using powers. Everything is reductible to the same old 1, 2, 3. This is a table that's filled with all sorts of things that I can't, I spent hours with it and I felt like I was only scratching the surface, just looking at it in an arithmetic way, the relationships between them. Between each set of numbers, there are proportions, such that if we look at the involutionary side, it is 4 to 3, 9 to 8, 4 to 3, 4 to 3, 9 to 8, 4 to 3, 4 to 3, 9 to 8, 4 to 3. These numbers, which are factors of powers of 2 and 3, these proportions between them represent, again, the intervals between them. It turns out that each of these represents the proportions of a scale. On the other side, on the evolutionary side, are you familiar with in music, like going all the way back to Hindu music? Every music of the world, even Western music, used to have descending and ascending scales. Like there used to be a different minor scale descending from ascending. And if you ever listen to Ravi Shankar, he gives you all of the scales descending and ascending, and it has to do with the embodiment of spirit and the disembodiment of spirit. On the ascending side, it is 3 to 2, 4 to 3, 3 to 2, 3 to 2, 4 to 3, 3 to 2, 3 to 2, 4 to 3, 3 to 2. Or these are just the proportions in another way, saying that the second number is 1.5 times the size of the first, or 1 1/3 is the difference there. It is the proportions which count. The ratios between the numbers are what give the intervals that make up a scale. In a spiritual sense, if you can tune in using the whole idea of projecting a point in concentration, and then moving it out into a line, and then a surface, and then a solid, and then stepping into it, is again the materialization of spirit. Whereas the reduction of that back to the point is the spiritualization of matter. Now this is all tied together by this other table over here, which uses old terms which aren't used much anymore except by historians of music. If you'll note, in each of the secondary columns, there are 5 pairs of numbers that are generated. And between these pairs, if you look at them carefully, breaking them down into factors of powers, you'll see that there are patterns in them. And each of those patterns had meanings, which we're not going to go into because it would be way, way, way too much. These series could be carried on ad infinitum. But the reason only 5 pairs are taken is because 5 was the number of, remember, that's what was in the astrology class. The 3, 4, 5 has, the 5 has, the 3 is the number of spirit, 4 is the number of matter, and 5 is the number of soul being taken out of matter back into spirit. And 5 was the number of a wedding. It was the wedding of the 2 and of the 3. The 5th house is still the house of gold, and getting off into too many sideline topics. But the 5 are taken as the union between the other 2. That is between the involutionary and the evolutionary, which have to do with the basic 2, and 3 wed together in 5. This produced a study of harmonics so that there were 5 what were called symphonies. And these 5 symphonies had to do with tonal relations, that if you could understand and live these tonal relationships, you would have spiritual experiences that would attune you to the different planes as they were wed and woven together. I know this is awfully dryly mathematical, but the symphonies were called the diatessaron, the diapenta, the diapason, the diapason diapenta, and the disdiapason. And the proportions that were involved were the sesquiterteon, the sesquialter, the duple, the treble, the quadruple, the sesquioctave, which is outside of the symphonies, and the octuple. These are the only proportions that you find, simple proportions that you find among the numbers in the primary and secondary chart. And these are the actual numbers for the proportions are given to the next to the proportion names, such as the octuple is 8 to 1. And the sesquioctave is 9 to 8. And the scales that turn out to be for the symphonies are, for the diatessaron, it's 2 whole notes and a semitone. If you understand that interval, and you understand 3 whole tones and a semitone, or if you understand the whole tone scale, 6 whole tones, or if you understand the diapason diapenta, which is 9 whole tones and 1 semitone, or if you understand the disdiapason, which is 12 whole tones, if you understand them, you understand all of the regenerative relationships between the structures of the manifestation of the cosmos, according to the Pythagoreans, based totally on arithmetics. This is not based on the division of a string, but it happens to harmonize in many ways with the division of the string. This is completely spiritual mathematics or spiritual arithmetic. So all you have to do is tune into that. Much easier. I don't know how to say this, but if you study Pythagorean mathematics, you begin to look for harmonies of meanings of numbers in your life. And you associate them with pitches and such like that. This also was used by them. These numbers were put onto what was called the Wheel of Pythagoras, and they were used for divination and prediction. This was also used for magic. This was also used for having a code to speak with each other. It was also used for studying the proportions of the different parts of the body. All of these sorts of things the Pythagoreans did with numbers in this fashion. Okay, I think we've looked enough at that. You can write these things down. If you